and welcome to episode number 21 in the Signal Integrity Journal's Fundamentals podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bogatin. I'm the technical editor of the Signal Integrity Journal. Today, I'm pleased to have with me Heidi Barnes, the Power Integrity Product Specialist at Keysight Technologies. She's really a power integrity industry icon. I caught up with Heidi at DesignCon 2024. Join me in my chat where I learned, among other things, about her up-close and personal encounter with a great white and some of the other challenges in high-speed interconnects. So I'm here with Heidi Barnes at DesignCon, and I've really been looking forward to this chance to catch up because I know you're doing so many things here at DesignCon and elsewhere. But before we get into that, I wanted to get a little bit of your background. I know you went to Caltech, and it was EE or physics?
So, you know, you always have ambitions. I think when you first started a college, you don't really know what you're going to do and where you're going to end up. So I was going to be a mechanical engineer, and then they started getting into the fluid dynamics, and I said, you know, electrical looks much better. And I like the fields and, you know, The circuits and all of that. And I have to say, I did have an internship at Hewlett-Packard as a high school student.
Wow.
And I was loading printed circuit boards with, we called them chocolate drop capacitors and dog bone inductors, and and we'd load the boards and they'd go off to the solder wave.
Wow.
And so,
usually I find in a lot of students the other way, they take an electromagnetics class and they're like, oh my gosh, this isn't for me. I'm going to do something physical, something mechanical. You went the other way.
I went the other way. And yeah, 1986, I graduated from Caltech, and I was, again, I didn't really know what I wanted to specialize in quite yet in terms of electrical engineering. And so I didn't go on for my doctorate. I went straight out into industry. And my first job was making solar cells for Arco Solar, which
Wow.
has been bought by Siemens. And
Yeah.
So it's very, very exciting for me.
And then you've been in industry all this time.
Yes.
Was it Avantas that you used to work for?
Correct. Like I said, I started, my first job was Hewlett-Packard, and eventually I did come back in 97. I came back to Hewlett-Packard, and then it became Agilent, and then Agilent spun, I was with the ATE group. They spun us off as Verigy, and then that was bought by Advantest. And then again, I had done a lot of microcircuit packaging at Agilent, Keysight, in the High Frequency Technology Center for RF microwave applications. But when I went to the ATE side of the house, I started learning how to do high frequency printed circuit boards and for signal integrity and power integrity and high speed digital applications. But one of the problems is when you're working, I really wanted to know what was under the hood of the simulation technology. Even back then, I wanted simulation to measurement correlation. It's difficult. It's not easy. So I had a very keen interest in knowing what was under the hood in the simulation technology and how to really get it to match measurement. So I went back to Agilent.
Was the simulation, was that in the days of MDS or ADS?
No, this was ADS.
ADS.
MDS was way back in the 80s. I used MDS
that
for maybe,
me.
80s and the 90s. I used MDS maybe for 1 year in 97, 98, and then they came out with, the first version of ADS.
I think I met you when you were at Verigy then, and you were doing high-speed test boards.
Correct. And with Jose Marrera with Advantest, he's in Böblingen in Germany, and he's a great collaborator on papers. He got me involved with DesignCon, actually.
Yeah.
He's the one. And you're really investigating how do you do these high-speed traces on load boards. And, very quickly, realize with high-speed digital, you can't route everything on the top layer. The RF microwave guys have a few traces, and they route a microstrip.
They don't like vias,
They don't like vias. But high-speed digital, you have to do it.
Yeah.
And high-speed digital, you can't put 40,000 vias in your board. You can't route anything. So you also have to understand transmission line theory a lot more in terms of the transitions and controlled impedance, and you have to get into the inner layers to do
and
that.
So you've come full circle after starting with HP and taking that detour through the spin-offs, coming back to Keysight now.
Correct. And like I said, now that I'm at Keysight, I didn't go back to the sort of test and measurement side, equipment side of things, I went to the simulation department where we have ADS or EDA department. And that's allowed me to really work with the R&D engineers and really understand how the simulation tools work. So that's been very beneficial. And then I can influence where our next generation products are going. And I started with signal integrity. That was, you know, the big thing about 10 years ago or more. But now you'll see even DesignCon 2024, it's amazing how many power integrity papers there are and some really big challenges. This was maybe one of my most exciting years to see Steve Sandler turn on 2,000 amps. and what is it? He's saying it's about 1,000 amps a nanosecond. So it's nanoseconds, you know, step change in current. And it was exciting because I, you know, it was a really team effort with Adan Ben Ezra in Israel and Broadcom, and very fun. We had, you know, weekly meetings with him and Ben Dannon of Signal Edge Solutions, and also Uni with MPS. They make the power supply modules, and then Steve Sandler guiding us all along and telling us what he needs to get this step load design done.
Well, before we get into the 2,000 amps
in
2 nanoseconds, you also have a very interesting sideline of, I think you've once described it as, you're involved in any sport that involves water in whatever phase it's in.
In whatever phase. Correct. Ice skating,
underwater hockey.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more recently, I'm working on my sailing adventures. So
trying to do that. Top of the water.
Yes.
And you also do, is it free diving for abalone?
I do free diving for abalone. California has some the restrictions now, so I'm doing more spearfishing. And then I think, you know, I also tried a little bit of lobster diving, but that's on hold again for a little while.
And I know at one time a couple of years ago when you were free diving, you had an encounter with a friend out there.
Yes, I had. I called him the little guy, and he's steadily gotten bigger. So that was my attempt at doing, I am certified for scuba diving, and I like free diving more, but if you're going to go lobster diving, scuba's much better because you can stay down there and chase them. So I went on a lobster dive in Channel Islands with one of my underwater hockey friends. And anyways, and because I'm pretty comfortable in the water, I don't use up the air in the tanks very fast. So I was sort of last person back to the boat, which was not a good thing. And so, this my friendly, large friend, which I can now say is probably about the size of my van, came swimming by to see me.
So, it was a great white.
So I looked
up. And you looked like a seal.
I probably did.
You had a black suit on and fins.
I had my free diving, so it's a little bit more of a camouflage.
Uh-huh.
And I got my scuba tanks on, and I was swimming on the top of the water, and it was, he was, you know, or she was very curious, because if you think about it, it wasn't like, it was like, you know, chasing me or anything. I looked up and realized, you know, that I see everybody on the boat kind of looking at me, and I'm thinking, oh, good, they see me. But then when I put my head back in the water, I realized they had seen the shark come up first.
Oh, my gosh.
And so when I looked at it and looked down and saw that it had the big white stripe, I pull my head out of the water, I see the big fin, and the boat's too far. You know, you're not going to make it that far. So.
And you don't have anybody swimming slower than you to.
No, because like I said, I was, I hold my, it was, I don't use up the air that much, so I was slow. But anyways, it was interesting because, you know, I turned around. I was like, okay, I can't turn my back on what. So I turned around to look at where the shark was, and she had turned around too. So we were face to face. And, you know, it's like this big tennis ball black eye, you know, a couple feet away. And she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, you know, you hear all these stories about you should punch them in the nose.
Yeah.
So I have.
Did that actually come to mind when.
Oh, yeah. So I have my scuba vest, you know, skier, and it has a vest, and I'm reaching for my. I have an ab iron for getting scallops. So I'm a terrible lobster diver. I had only gotten scallops, no lobsters. But I found my ab iron, which is a blunt little sort of metal blade that you can pry things with.
Uh-huh.
I pull that out, and it's all about, you know, 10 inches long.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like trying to think whether I should punch it in the nose, and it's like, oh, I can't do it because it's this big round nose.
Very
really
big.
Quiet.
Uh-huh.
But I have freediving fins on. So a few of the divers on the boat and the person I went down with, it said, oh, you need your freediving fins because it takes less energy to kick because they're about, 2.5 feet long.
Uh-huh.
So I decide, well, I'm going to just lean back and see if I can punch it, kind of give it a little kick in the nose. And so I'm leaning back and my fins are probably like an inch from its nose. I'm trying to get up the nerve to kind of poke it away. And all of a sudden its mouth flies open. And my big memory of it is just, it was like, oh, it's a big circle. So you hold your arms in a circle.
Uh-huh.
It was a circle of triangle teeth.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very distinct, great white shape of triangle teeth. And then that was at that instant, I believe my brain said, okay, we're going full instinct mode. No thinking, because there's a gap in what I remember. I don't remember it lunging or anything.
Yeah.
But the next memory I have was wonderful because my fins popped off. So it's like the feeling sensation of the fin, this tug, and their free diving fins, their foot pockets. He got both fins.
Wow.
And I see him about 15 feet down or 10 feet down with two fins in his mouth going down. And I was so excited.
Left a bad taste in his mouth of rubber.
Well, my friends had seen the thing uplet well, and my friend had jumped into the inflatable, and then he's like, I don't know how to start it. So he's yelling, and so then the owner of the boat jumps in, and they start the motor, and they're coming to get me. Well, when the shark goes to grab my fins, comes completely out of the water and over my head.
Oh my God.
So all they see is this 16-foot shark roll over the top of me.
Wow.
And I spin around, and with no fins and you have a big heavy tank, you're wobbling.
Uh-huh.
So I'm yelling shark. And they're kind of like, oh no. And so they were probably, 100 feet away by then or something. They're coming pretty fast. It was only about 3 to 5 seconds later, and they yanked me out of the water.
Wow.
And it took two of them, one guy pulling the, launched me into their inflator.
Yeah.
But
no pictures?
Oh, I have, not of the shark.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't have a GoPro on.
Oh.
Maybe next time.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully
yeah.
never. But what was interesting was I did get six stitches. So I didn't yank my feet fast enough.
Oh,
my gosh.
It
caught my right foot.
Uh-huh.
And the tooth went through the foot pocket of the fin and into my toe as I'm pulling my foot out.
Wow.
And what's crazy is the tooth, two teeth hit me, one between my toes, and then one it sort of in the, a little bit further back into where I had the six stitches. But it missed all the bone and the muscle.
Wow.
And
wow.
My sister likes to say, that's all you got? But what's interesting, and this is the engineer in us, this is the spacing between the tooth marks. So my fins float. So the fins floated back up to the top. So that's
uh-huh,
how
uh-huh.
we know how, another way to say how big it is.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at the teeth spacing of about 4 millimeters or 4 centimeters,
yeah.
it works out to be like a 15 or 16 foot great white. And the other one, the other one I think I've always kind of been interested in looking at was the, let's see if I can find it here. They're actually not a very expensive fin. They're Rob Allen's, but when the shark grabbed the fins, there's a white compression mark. So you could probably, if you're a mechanical engineer,
uh-huh,
figure
uh-huh.
out how much pressure
uh-huh.
could create that white compression into the plastic.
Wow. And so you were able to recover the fins after
you let
go of them.
So
uh-huh.
that was the nice thing about these fins. And then I got a discount on a replacement pair. And I got a free shark shield that I get to wear, which I go to the EMC conference and I'm like, does this really work? the field's underwater. Am I really going to, this little shock wave, is it going to really keep the sharks away?
Uh-huh.
And then I also did get another one that's kind of fun is with technology is I did get airlifted by the Coast Guard. And so the little red helicopter came and they dropped the line down because
uh-huh.
we were out at the farthest island in the Channel Islands. And so then I went up in the basket and off to the hospital.
Well, that's an adventure.
And my dive buddies went to a different island and continued their scuba diving trip.
Wow. Well, I'm really glad you made it back.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad you left a bad taste in the mouth of that shark.
I did. And I haven't seen one since. So
uh-huh.
I'm very,
Good.
Very happy about
Good.
That.
Okay, so now let's go back to the other adventure you've had this last year, working on 2,000 amps in a couple of nanoseconds.
Yes.
So this is a Slimer circuit used to characterize the power supplies?
So there's 512 gallium nitride devices from EPC, and those very fast, high-power switches, or what I want to say, they can handle a lot of current and they can switch very quickly. Those power FETs are in array. And then
so
he's
all
got
in parallel.
Yeah, all in parallel.
Uh-huh.
And basically what you do is, so anyways, 512 of these GaN switches, and then they're tied on their to the magic resistor, we call it. So there's TFT, Thin Film Technologies. Mark Broman helped work with Steve Sandler to make this very special resistor for dumping that current
and
not overheating.
And that's the current sense
resistor? And it has the current sense, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But anyways.
And it's like milliohms of resistance?
I'd have to look back at my, because you have 512. So basically, it's 40, we got down to about 40 microohms, which is where we went.
Uh-huh.
So was it 512 times 40 microohms?
So you turn on a voltage pulse on the gates, and then they open up, you get the current through the sense resistor?
So what's interesting is Steve actually, it's computer, he's got a little control system there, so he can modulate turning those, you know, which ones he wants to turn on, so he can adjust how much current.
So each of the 512 are individually controlled?
Yes.
Wow. Or in banks, probably.
I'm trying to think, what was I say? The key thing is that you can modulate them at different frequencies and come up with different patterns. So, and you're right, because you're going to turn on. So yeah, they're individually controlled, because you don't want to always just dump 2,000 amps. You want to be able to do different amperage, and you want to do different patterns. I think he's even thinking about like a PRBS pattern not a true data pattern necessarily, but mimicking going in and out of power save modes, and what would that on-off sort of pattern look like.
So you slam the current in some controlled way, you monitor that current with the voltage across the sense resistor.
So what he's actually doing is he's done a sort of a via for sensing, and not necessarily I think that may be part of the magic resistor, but you're basically, you don't want to disturb the circuit with your probes. And so what he actually is using a near field probe. And there's a sense via that's nearby that's picking up the magnetic field. Yeah, the magnetic field.
Because
you don't want to disturb the circuit. And so so the near field works to be a much better non-intrusive measurement. And I don't know if you follow that. It's a really fun thing. And even the low-end scopes will do it, is a near field probe will see the dynamic current. You know, you'll get a change in the in your loop. It'll create
you see the change in magnetic field, change in current.
Yeah, it's
from
classic
the source.
EM theory. But what's fun is if you integrate that, you then get the square wave pulse. So you basically get the time domain square pulse from those dynamic currents on the E field.
And then you have some kind of calibration to put a known current and feel like what that field is and
right.
that integration.
So you can calibrate it and that sort of thing. And he's done, I think, what did he do? I think, was it Load Slammer? So he's done a bunch of comparisons, and he's actually done some, you know, current sense technology versus the near field probe, and he gets very, very close on the results. So, and I've also used the near field probe, because when we're characterizing a voltage regulator module and we want to get the few parameters to populate the Sandler state space average model, which is basically, you have a control loop. So you need how do you model a control loop? Well, state space average models, or state space modeling of control loops, has been around for a long time. Mechanical engineers use it. But it's basically just a behavioral model of this control loop, and you have this pulse width modulation on your going into your inductor and capacitor. And the hard part, though, is when populating that model, where do you get the parameters, and how do you verify that your behavior model is correct? So if you, one of the places you want to measure a lot of times is at that switch node, to really see what are the edge rates of the upper and lower MOSFET, because that'll give you your spectral content. So you need to get the correct spectral content coming out of your model so that you get a good representation of what it's doing. So anyways, to probe the high voltage switch node with all the dynamic currents and everything there, most of the times you're disturbing it and you're not really getting good measurement.
Or you're getting pickup from someplace you don't want.
Yeah, so if you come in with a near field probe, there's usually that spot is pretty easy to come in with a near field probe and pick up the switching edges. And Stevie even has said, well, I can even do it on a PIMIC where it's completely packaged. You put the near field probe, you sort of identify what that pulse width modulation is, and then you get at least an idea of what those edge rates are.
That's clever. So if you have an already packed switch mode power supply module, you can still sense what's going on the inside with a near field probe.
With a near field probe. So depending on, you know, maybe what they've done there, but it's worth a try to see whether you can pick up that edge rate and see what's going on. It's just another parameter is pretty easy to measure. The other one, of course, is output impedance we use. The data sheet gives you some parameters. Sometimes you can use, the LT Spice or the Simplest to get the parameters out of there, and you're kind of always cross-checking to see if they all kind of correlate, and then that lets you populate this state-space average model, behavioral model of that regulated, power regulation, DC to DC conversion. And what's fascinating then is this model that Steve came up with, that state space average model is small signal, and it figures out what the duty cycle is for the given load. And then that duty cycle feeds into dynamic switches for giving you the large signal.
So when you do that characterization of a switch mode supply to match to the, get the model parameters, they're really nonlinear. And so when you do the small signal, do you vary the DC load then and look at the small signal kind of the output impedance at different loads?
So, you say vary the load. Well, it's a big variation because we can't access the control loop. So, if you have a packaged VRM or, PIMIC or something, there's no way you're going to open up the control loop and look at the Bode, or Nyquist
coefficients,
coefficients and whatnot to see what that control loop's doing. But it turns out that if you're looking at output impedance, the on and off output impedance is basically off is the, control loop is
the passive element.
Yeah, passive. And then and then you turn it on and now you've got the control loop working. So that very giant difference in load gives you enough information to look at the Bode plot. So that output impedance you can identify where's the active impedance peak from the control loop, because off you don't see it, and on you can see where it's going from the inductance of the VRM control loop to the capacitance.
So when you look at the output impedance, right, it's really looking into the power supply, the input impedance of it,
right,
and you look at it compared to when it's off versus when the load is on, there's usually a frequency at which you're seeing the passive elements and that doesn't change.
Yeah, your bulk capacitors are huge. And so that you see that huge bulk capacitance.
So where is that kind of frequency where below that you're seeing the control loop of the power supply and above that you're seeing all the passive elements?
So there's a fun little trick. That's another one that if you understand power supply theory, and this is another one I got from Steve, because you start getting into how fast is the control loop. Because if the power supply can respond faster, I don't need as much bulk capacitance. And if it responds faster, its output inductance is lower, basically. That's what you're saying. It's got less inductance. It can respond faster at higher frequencies, which means I need less bulk capacitance because it can keep up with the load.
To flatten the impedance.
Right, to flatten the impedance. So, but what's interesting is every DC to DC converter has a switching frequency, right? And it's just kind of, classic sort of electrical or sampling theory and things like that. I'm pulse width modulating. I've got this, DC to DC converter frequency. I can't control above that frequency. If something's changing faster than that frequency, I can't keep up because I'm slow. I'm at a switching frequency.
Pulse
anything above that, it's too
pulses.
Fast. I can't change things fast enough. So it's pretty common sense. So then you start talking to Steve, and he did a paper for SPI on this model, and where he's accurate and where he's not. Turns out if you get, as you start approaching the switching frequency, you get all sorts of, nonlinear and some weird behavior. So he's always saying you want to be 1/6 the switching frequency. Okay. So that's
the
kind of
control loop
for the,
fastest
so your
response.
Control loop for controlling the output current and staying up with the load is about 1/6 the switching frequency. If you go above that, you risk maybe getting into some nonlinear, some, you know, behavior that his model's not really going to cover, but he doesn't care because you really want to be in, you know, in a very stable region and predictable. So that's my trick. When people say, the data sheet doesn't tell me the bandwidth and I can't do a Bode plot and I don't have anything to do measurement. I say, well, if you go, you know what the switching frequency is, you know, 1 megahertz or 500 kilohertz, and we were using 500 kilohertz. You take 1/6 of that, and that frequency, where that, you basically take that frequency point on an inductor and your target impedance, and where they cross, that's, so that's basically going to be,
that tells you the impedance of the capacitor that you want.
Well, you know, you take your target impedance, okay, and then you know the frequency, so you draw an inductor that goes through that frequency point and that target impedance, and that gives you your RL model that you want to use for a VRM. So if you don't have any idea how to model that VRM, that's step one. If you is the switching frequency, the target impedance that you know, that'll tell you what inductance, that active inductance is for that control loop bandwidth.
And so that says that generally, if you know the switching frequency, rule of thumb is 1/6 that, it's going to be the control loop frequency. And so above that frequency, when you look at the impedance, you're going to see just the passive elements.
You're going to start to see the passive elements
taking
over.
And below that, you're going to see the active elements and the control of the active elements.
And it's a really crude rule of thumb.
Yeah.
A lot of times when I get a design from somebody and I don't have any information on the power supply really other than the switching frequency, I can at least get an RL model to start. And I have some confidence that that's in the right ballpark. Yeah.
And you can do a sanity check of, given that RL coming out, what value capacitor you want for it.
So, and now I know the L. Now I know the bulk C.
Yeah.
And now I can flatten out my impedance. And that's why I always start at the VRM. Because I get my bulk caps correct. And then I just start marching along up. Because the bulk cap, you want as much of the power as you can to come from that bulk cap that has a controlled ESR to match with your load or your power supply and going to match with your load. Once you get up to the really small caps, it's a lot harder to really sometimes control that ESR because you're trying to put, and the small caps have very little capacitance, so you're having to put a lot of them in a small area. And
to get the ESR low enough to be the lower than the target impedance.
Right, you're trying to get that last bit of capacitance to bring the inductance down.
Yeah. So the application for this 2,000 amp electronic load is for power supplies that are feeding some of these real high-end, like AI network chips?
AI network chips. So, you know, the AI chips obviously are taking a lot of current. The interesting thing, though, too, is...
Are they really taking, like, 2,000 amps of current?
Steady state, 5,000 amps peak to peak.
5,000 amps peak to peak. So between idle and turning on and doing a lot of... completing word, completing sentences, and coming up with poems.
And I was talking with some people. It's interesting because they're battling a lot of stuff. So when an AI chip fires off, it's not like the whole circuit lights up. It's kind of a wave starting at one end with the circuitry, and so there's all sorts of challenges with, and what does that do with the thermal if it's not balanced with all of the so there's a huge thermal problem. But the other thing that's interesting to me is there are also a lot of these AI applications, you know, that's like a big massive chip, but you also have chiplets coming. And chiplets is having, because you can put multiple die on this larger substrate, but it's still a small area. So they're going to have a power issue. And I think there wasn't necessarily an AI one. There was like a networking chip. So it was a switch device with thousands of IOs. That was another one where they wanted 2,000 amps in like a square inch of area.
Okay, so how do you feed 2,000? I mean, a car battery, when you're starting a car with those great big battery clips, it's like 400 or 500 amps. How do you do 2,000 amps into a tiny little chip area?
So that was one of the simulations. Heidi, Steve's like, you need to do the thermal. Yeah, you need a thermal simulation. okay, I'll run it, run the thermal. So we have a nice tool with PI Pro, Power Integrity in ADS. That's our EM simulation tool. And we use the same mesh as the DC IR drop. It's basically the same mathematics, but it's for thermal. And we include the dielectrics in. But it looks at the whole board and all the components, and you can put thermal properties on them. So I ran this thing with, you know, with all these 512 little GaN chips and the resistors, and I get like 760 degrees Celsius, you know, this thing's going to just melt. And then I went the other way. I went and put, you know, ideal cooling on it, water cooling, and did sort of the ideal one. But then it drops it to 37 degrees. It's like, oh, okay, we need cooling, Steve. But, you know, of course, he already knew that. But yeah. He has a big water cooling manifold, a big copper plate that sits over there. And,
okay, so that's for the E-load. But what about the poor guy that has to build the chip that's going to get 2,000 amps? How do you actually deliver 2,000 amps through traces and planes?
But that was one of the questions here. You know, you have to, you know, how many layers are devoted to thick copper to get that out. So
what do you typically find as kind of the thickness is like 5 ounce, 10 ounce copper, and like a dozen layers?
You know, I think it depends on the application, and you do need the, you know, the 2 ounce copper, the maybe the 4 ounce, but it's and a lot of it's, you know, the layers and how the vias are done and some of that.
Yeah, I've heard that. I used to use a rule of thumb of like an amp per V at max. Now I'm hearing that folks saying, that's not enough. You got to use 2 amps per via. Otherwise, you just can't get enough vias
to get the heat out.
Or to get the current up to the device.
Oh, okay.
So you're talking about thousands of power ground vias just to get that current into the device.
Right. And the other thing I think, too, maybe I'd have to look back at that. Doug Brooks did a nice book on thermal. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there are some... We early on when we did our thermosimulator, one of the examples we used was I think it's IPC standard. They will look at a trace, and they sort of correlated that to a via. But the via actually does a pretty good job of conducting heat through the dielectric and the material sideways, whereas a trace on the top of the board doesn't have that because of the air. Air is a bad conductor. Mm-hmm. And so vias, some of those rules, or was it IPC standards, are a little bit conservative. So I could see them bumping that up to 2 amps.
But even so, it is still astonishing to think that, you know, you have the equivalent to like 5 or 6 car terminal cables that have to feed the 2,000 amps to this tiny little chip.
But if you think about it, even the 1-inch square example really does, and that one may hit the limits of practicality. But if you think about it, most of these designs, all the IO is power and ground. It, you know, like 90% of it is power and ground. And so then if you put your, you know, and then it's like, okay, well, you know, a half inch solid coax is
sure.
Or solid, you know.
Yeah. But then you have all of the planes feeding it that have holes in them to get the clearance holes.
But you also have to remember that's the other reason why a lot of these power supplies are brought closer together. So they're not the point of load. I mean, that's the whole reason for point of load power supplies is that impedance, that resistance from a distance, you're going to get too much heat. And so you've got to get those point of load power supplies close. And that was we did our paper. Do you drop from 48 volts directly to 0.8 volts, or do you go 48 to 12 to...
And what is that trade-off? How do you make that kind of a decision?
So again, it depends, and you know, I think analog devices went one way and MPS went the other, so sort of two competing philosophies, and Steve likes to say you can make either one look better than the other, but they both have their caveats. You know, obviously if I do two stages, I've got more components. One stage, maybe I don't have, it's a little bit more challenging to get the regulation controlled.
Can you get comparable efficiency whether you're going from 48 to 1 or 48 to 12 and 12 to 1?
I think, I think the efficiency, you're probably, you know, but, you know, the two stage probably has a little bit, you know, takes a little more, but then you have maybe a little bit better control of the noise and stuff going through. So, you know, less, you have more protection against the noise and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's trade-offs, and it depends. Yeah. And I think one of Steve's things was, well, the load's not energy efficient. So you're all, you know, talking about...
It's all going into heat.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he also kind of says it's all about the load. The load makes money. the power supply doesn't. Uh-huh. And so one of the challenges, I think, in the power supply industry is it just has to be good. It doesn't have to be the best,
uh-huh.
because the load is where the money's being yeah. made.
So. You know, that is a great tagline. Is the load is what makes money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Well, that's all the time we have for today.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for sharing your story of your great white as well.
I thank you for listening.
And it sounds like the challenges in delivering power to devices are maybe even as difficult to deal with as the challenges in sending 224 gig signals down our lossy channel. So
I think they're both very challenging. Yeah. I thought there was a really funny sort of connection. I don't know. It's just one of those. So they're looking at 1.6 terabit, right? And on the signal integrity side, and how are we going to get there? And then on the power integrity side, there's this magic 1600 watts. of how do I get 1600 uh-huh. watts in a square inch, and,
uh-huh.
and so they're both on a race to see which one's going to be the hardest going forward for chiplets and AI and uh-huh. all of these advanced technologies uh-huh. coming.
No end of challenges to pay attention to in the no. future, and job security for all of us in the industry.
And definitely, and DesignCon 2024 was great. The participation was growing. Wrote lots of excellent papers. And, really
we'll
fun.
Hear more about this in DesignCon 25.
2025, yes.
Heidi, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much, Eric.
And that concludes my interview. My thanks to Heidi Barnes for joining us, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I hope you check out all of our other podcasts at the Signal Integrity Journal. And that's 30 for this edition.